The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This Saturday, we have the story of one composer, 1 hour, and four great songs that endure one century later. Plus, Jeff Love tells me about Manuel's biggest hit. We'll swing by Sri Lanka, and we'll hear from Al Jolson's godson. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along, July 3rd, 2024. It is 3 p.m. in New Hampshire on the eve of Independence Day, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London on the eve of Election Day, 9 p.m. in Paris, 4 days before Election Day, 10 p.m. in Kiev. No Election Day there. Zelensky's cancelled the election. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, sorry about that. 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, still kind of sorry, but not really as much. 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more civilised hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. July the 1st. Was Dominion Day, Canada's national holiday. July the 4th is Independence Day, America's national holiday. But did you know that July the 3rd is the national holiday of Belarus, Liberation Day, marking the liberation of Minsk by Soviet troops on this day 80 years ago, 1944, and the end of German occupation. Oh, and July the 3rd is also Julian Assange's Liberation Day. It's his birthday, and his first birthday at liberty in 14 years. Okay, lots going on around the world. Let us get to your questions. Drew Weber writes, "Hello, Mark. According to sources in the White House, Biden is cogent, typically between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. That's, let's see, that's 6 hours. That's a quarter of the day. So he's only non-cogent for 75% of the day. So he's cogent typically between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., says Drew Weber, outside of which not so much. Taking a page from a past Hillary campaign, will we see a commercial about who's best to take a 4:01 p.m. telephone call? Say Biden drops out of the race due to questions of his mental fitness, how can he continue as president for the next 6+ months? Would the argument be that he is sharp as a tack now, but would not be on January the 20th, 2025? Seems his only backstop is the potential reality of a President Harris. Your thoughts?" Let's hear a couple more questions on that theme. Ray Finocchiaro, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, says, "Jill Biden is increasingly being called out for elder abuse of Joe Biden in her blatant power grab to remain first lady. Your take on the not-so-good doctor?" Elisa Angel asks, if Kamala Harris were to replace Joe Biden on the Democrats' presidential ticket, would that be an improvement? I am asking for the Dems. Well, you know, the step back a bit. I generally take the Neil Oliver view of these things. Neil was a colleague of mine at GB News, and he came on the show once and he said, this stuff is happening because the powers that be want it to happen. So the same people, the same awful, useless, dreadful American media, the same people who 10 days ago were assuring us that all these videos of Biden wandering around lost at the G7 were cheap fakes and all that. So the same people who were telling us 10 days ago, there's nothing to see here, folks, and now are saying that this is the July 4th holiday is make or break for the Biden campaign. By Monday, he might not be here, blah, 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 blah. So the first thing to do is, and by the way, some of these, the New York Times is now citing some of the same videos that it dismissed as cheap fakes a week and a half ago as evidence of Joe Biden's mental decline. So we're in a literal illustration. If you haven't yet heard my adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, of a phenomenon in 1984 where everyone's on message with being at war with East Asia, and then it turns on a sixpence and East Asia is our ally. We're in a literal illustration of that. The same videos that were cheap fakes a week and a half ago are now evidence of Joe Biden's mental decline. By the way, if you haven't been able to tell these last 3.5 years that Joe Biden is mentally declining, you're the one with a cognitive disability. So this whole thing is deep fake move that has been authorized by the powers that be for their own purpose. But assuming that there are now parties interested in getting rid of... One of the reasons, by the way, they just had some polls leaked today showing that Trump is now competitive in states where Republican candidates haven't been competitive in decades. He's half a point ahead, I think it is, in New Mexico, for example. In my own state of New Hampshire, Trump is supposedly 3 points ahead, which I don't really believe, given that during my time in the Granite State, it has purpled and then blued. But just for the record, if Trump is 3 points ahead in New Hampshire, then he's on course for the biggest Republican victory since Ronald Reagan in 1984. That's assuming, obviously, that America is willing to hold a free and fair election. No Republican presidential candidate has won New Hampshire since George W. Bush in 2000. 4 electoral college votes, but those 4 are the reason Bush became president in 2000, because without them, he wouldn't have been president. So you can look up your own state on this, but the map has expanded. And if we go back to 2020, in order to put Joe Biden in the White House, Democrats had to get up to the usual shenanigans in 6 blue cities in 6 purple states. Once you factor in a place like New Hampshire, which doesn't really have any cities, so, you know, stealing it means stealing it in a lot of rinky-dink towns with a few hundred votes. That can get costly and prohibitively complex. So right now, the way the map is going, they are going to have to steal the election on a scale that they have never done before. And if that is the case, you can understand why they might be seeking alternatives. To be clear, you can forget about Gavin Newsom, you can forget about Gretchen Whitmer, you can forget about any of them except Kamala Harris, because there is no way. Right now, turnout is already depressed among key elements of the Democrat base, such as blacks and Hispanics. If you wanted to depress it to pre-Civil Rights Act depths, you would boot Kamala Harris off the ticket. She's the vice president. She's been the vice president for 3.5 years. You can't say, oh yeah, we just, the black woman thing? Yeah, that was just a little bit of window dressing. You don't think we seriously want to put a black woman in the Oval Office, do you? So it's not going to be, they're not going to get rid of Kamala Harris to put some snooty white lady like Gretchen Whitmer or some blow-dried twit like Gavin Newsom in there instead. If, in other words, here's the thing. If Biden goes, it's Kamala. And therefore, because Kamala is A, rubbish at campaigning, as we saw last time, and B, widely disliked by almost anybody who's encountered her, and C is strikingly inept, staggering around Europe and breezily declaring that Ukraine was already a member of NATO in 3 different European capitals or whatever it was. Kamala is going to have to be running for president as an incumbent, which means that Joe Biden is going to have to be gone by whatever Tuesday it is in November. That's the only option if they want to do something about this. And I've no idea why this has suddenly come up. Because we don't know who's been actually running things these last 3.5 years. It may not even be Americans. You know, the decision could be made. The decision about Biden could be being made by his controllers overseas. The big guy has had enough 10%. It's time to wave goodbye to him. We don't know who's been running the administration these past 3.5 years. But the point is, there's a tussle going back and forth between people who think they can up his dosage and keep him going till January 2029 and others who want out. And what that means is that these various factions are all going to have to buy in to whatever's being cooked up. But it is something that's being cooked up. It's nothing real. We don't know where it's going to end. On the matter of Jill Biden, Jill Biden has been married to Joe Biden for 50 years, which can't be easy on anyone. And I sometimes, you know, they're an extremely strange family. Let's just put it that way. Hunter Biden using his hookers as confessors. Hunter Biden's apparently living in the White House now as one of the trusted advisors. Joe Biden showering with his daughter. That book, if that book had been written by Ivanka Trump, for example, Donald Trump would be on the front page of every newspaper about it. Then we got Joe Biden's brother sending naked gay snaps to fellas all over the... They're a very weird family. And you can't help but wonder... I sometimes think of Jill Biden as a bit like Dolores Hope, Bob Hope's wife. We used to make jokes in television about the Dolores Hope moment, which is when you bring on the missus to do a sentimental duet with you, as Hope used to do with Dolores on... Silver Bells every Christmas show. But the fact is, she put up with an awful lot because Bob Hope was dogging around through his 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And then when he got to about 98, he didn't have the energy to hit on chorus girls anymore. And so he basically, in his last years, he came home and was sort of sitting in the lazy boy recliner. And Dolores sort of took control then and started making the album that he'd nixed for the previous half century and everything. Started doing all this stuff. And I don't rule out that Jill Biden is in a somewhat similar position there. Is it elder abuse? Joe, I'm not sure Joe Biden knows where he is most of the time. I don't really buy that 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. thing. She's not Edith Wilson, but she does ultimately have the say as to whether Biden stays or goes. And as I say, there's a timing issue here. They can't have a chaotic convention. He's supposed to be nominated in 2 weeks' time. If Kamala is a tough sell to the American people, but if you take the Democrats' identity politics thing, they'd be basically daring the American people to eject the first black female president after 6 months in office or whatever, or 3 months before the election or whatever. And they're probably pretty confident that they can blackmail the American people into not doing that. So if it's going to be Kamala, and as you know, if you read our comments section, Diane Calabresi has been saying it's Kamala, 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 Kamala. Two full terms plus the end of this term. But if he goes, he's going to be going, and it's going to be, and they stand a sporting chance of getting Kamala across the finish line if she's the incumbent. No chance if Biden sticks around until January. Then there's going to be all these questions about, you know, what did you know and when did you know it, and and I'm not sure, you know, they're very good. Veronica in Auckland has a theory that again, whoever's actually running things is clearing out the COVID-era leaders, Justin Trudeau, Emmanuel Macron, Rishi Sunak, because they're getting ready with virus X or whatever, and they figure it's more difficult if you're the same guy who locked everybody down a few years ago and wanted everybody jabbed a few years ago, and it's easier to do the routine all over again with a cast change. Johnny Woodrow says, "Dear Mark, as the demented sock puppet is joined by his cokehead son for meetings at the White House home for the elderly and criminally insane, I can't work out what we are seeing. Can you help? I assume evil people are cunning, but ultimately stupid. So are we seeing the cunning part or the stupid pigeons coming home to roost with these very public moments of apparent self-harm by the Biden crime family? Is the Democrat presidential campaign imploding because of stupidity, or are we seeing a cunning stage self-destruction preparing the way for Michelle Obama or someone else? Charlie Kirk et al. Seemed to think the debate was a great win for MAGA. I'm not convinced. P.S. What's the dress code for our Mad Max future? Will you keep up the tie and coordinated socks and handkerchief? I'm not sure I coordinate my socks and handkerchief. Or will you opt for leathers and an armoured truck for the post-apocalypse New Hampshire landscape?" says Johnny Woodrobe. I'll only tell you what I wore in the Sunni Triangle. I didn't do that look that all the foreign correspondents do, where they wear all those 70s safari suits, which I find a bit distracting because it reminds me of Roger Moore in The Spy Who Loved Me. So I always wear just my regular suit. I wear, when I was in the Sunny Triangle, I wore a slightly lighter weight suit, but I still wore a tie and my usual get-up, because I found it unnerved the natives. They weren't quite sure in which category to put me, so I felt it marginally lessened the chances that they'll kill you on that. As to what we're seeing, I think it's the latest it's the latest plot twist in a soap opera. So I I would think it's more part of a cunning phase. You mentioned Michelle Obama. It's possible, I suppose, that because Michelle Obama's a black woman, that you could remove... I'm not sure she's any more likable than Kamala, actually. But it's possible that you could remove Kamala to install her. But even then, I think you need to offer... You need to offer her something big, by which... And by big, I mean big. You'd have to force John Roberts to take early retirement and make Kamala Chief Justice or something like that. I mean, this is... That's one reason why... It's best to figure out that this is being done for some reason that is not necessarily... I mean, there's no point pretending it's real because, as I said, you know, everybody knew Joe Biden was out of it. And in Europe, for example, at the G7 and NATO summits, particularly in the smaller members, they all talk about it openly. They know that he's not going to come to the banquet because he can't handle a two-hour banquet making chit-chat with, you know, the Queen of Spain and the First Lady of France or whoever's sitting either side of him. They know he can't do it. They know he'll turn up for one photo op and maybe one meeting. And in the substantive meeting... it will be all the other guys from the vast US entourage who do all the talking. Nobody, except people who actually believe the American media, and I take it there are, you know, tens of millions of Democrats who do, but certainly the reporters covering it don't. Nobody thinks this is the sudden revelation. You know, this is, oh, the White House has kept us in the dark. That's completely ridiculous. Google, Google Biden being zonked out like a zombie, hanging there slack jaw. So this is rubbish. So we've got some kind of lame-o Democrat media dinner theatre going on, and there's no point pretending to take its ostensible script seriously because it's the subtext. It's the plot themes that aren't being spelled out yet that are actually what matter. That's the reality of that. It's going to go on. I would say this has got to be resolved quickly, if only because the Democrat convention is looming. And as I said, Kamala needs to be running as an incumbent. Gustav of Arimathea writes, "Hi, Mark. Thanks for introducing me to Serenade Radio and nuts to anyone who complained about music in the Q&A. Two quick questions. With all the palace intrigue going on at the White House, how did the people who matter think this would end? I can't figure out the strategy behind coming out of the basement, agreeing to a debate, and then basically admitting that you made a mockery of your own primary process." And the second question, has anyone noticed that we're no longer talking about 10% for the big guy? Thanks for all you do. Please avoid any heart attacks this week. Well, we were never really in. Most Americans don't know about 10% for the big guy. They don't know about any of that because their media has not told them. The difference between right and left is that the outposts of niche conservative media at least cover what the Democrat thinking is. The New York Times and the Washington Post and all the rest of it just do basically what they did with the Hunter Biden laptop. They don't cover it. They don't cover it at all. But I don't think... I think Biden was forced to, or whoever's operating Biden, was forced to offer Trump a debate. And they thought they'd got conditions, the idea of not having anybody in the room, because Trump likes to play off an audience, and then having Dana Bash and Jake Tapper, both of whom have compared Trump to Hitler, hosting it, and various other... They thought they'd come up with a... And the cut microphones whenever there were any interruptions. They thought they'd come up with a format that Trump would be obliged to say no to. So I'm not sure they even thought he'd actually be there on stage. And then again, I think they thought that he could... being prepped for a debate is not like being prepped for the State of the Union. I think they were under no illusions, but they didn't think it would be as bad as it was. Chris Davis writes from one of the other electoral battlegrounds. It's not a two-year thing like the United States. It's 6 weeks that ends tomorrow. But Chris Davis writes from the United Kingdom. Mark, I hope you're as well as you can be given your ongoing travails. What do you make of Peter Hitchens imploring voters to hold their nose and stick with the faux Conservatives in the UK tomorrow rather than moving to reform? I respect Peter, but on this he seems to me to have it badly wrong. What say you? Yeah, I think I'm with you there. Peter Hitchens wants people to back the Conservatives because of what Labour is about to do in certain constitutional ways once it takes power. He's right about that. There will be a certain amount of constitutional vandalism. They'll finish off what's left of the House of Lords. You would have to bet on some government of the future undoing the constitutional damage. But my problem with that is this. There's no way the Conservatives are going to win. So the argument being made is that the bigger the Conservative caucus, the more effective an opposition it will be. That's bollocks. They had an 80-seat majority and they haven't been an effective government, right? That's how crap they are. So the idea that, you know, if they're down to 50 seats, oh, that's terrible. Up to 75, better. But if we can get them to 120 seats, they'll be an effective opposition. Who's going to be an effective opposition, right? The Conservative Party that survives, whether it's 120 seats, whether it's 75, whether it's 50, is going to be all the left of centre One Nation Tories. So the idea of them as an effective opposition to Labour is bollocks on stilts, as Alistair Campbell liked to say. That is, and the bigger problem for me, and this is why I find Peter Hitchens' logic a bit odd, considering he was one of the first people in the British media to understand that this Conservative Party needed to be destroyed. We have had 14 awful years in which not a single Conservative thing has been done. Cameron, May, Johnson, Sunak, I've missed one, haven't I? Oh yeah, Liz Truss, the one they're all blaming it on for her, you know, 4 weeks she was Prime Minister, three of which were official mourning for her late Majesty. So, the oldest Conservative axiom, one that matters, is if you incentivize bad behavior, if you reward bad behavior, you'll get more of it. So if you reward the Tories for the 14 years of atrocious, treasonous behavior, the Conservative Unionist Party is neither conservative nor unionist. Now, everybody knows I've had my personal differences with Nigel Farage. Regard him as, I don't want to go into it. I see there were, you know, people in the comments section who think I'm bitter about it. I'm not bitter about it. I've endorsed the Reform Party because I think, one, for the sake of British conservatism, it is necessary to inflict as much damage as can be inflicted on this hideous Cameronite Sunak party, and as in Canada, for a new force to emerge. I hope Nigel is serious about that. I don't know whether he is, but certainly if you look at France, where Marine Le Pen has spent years building her party into the de facto opposition to the Uniparty. And we need something like that in other parts of the Western world too. So I don't accept Peter Hitchin's logic there. Sue Sims says, while I'm tempted to vote Reform, the chances of their actually getting more than a couple of seats are minimal, and voting Reform will mainly split the Tory vote, thus giving Labour an even bigger majority. Peter Hitchens, who's long been a foe of the non-conservative Tories and has in previous elections advised people to vote against them, this time round is telling people to vote for them in order to keep Labour out. What would be your reaction to this? Look, you can't keep Labour out. This is one of those swings of the pendulum. The Tories got in 1979. 1997, the pendulum swung and the Blairite Labour Party got in. 2010, the pendulum swung again and the Cameronite Tories got in. 24, 14 years. The difference is between now and 1997 is that Conservative voters have nothing to show for supporting this wretched party these last 14 years. Cameron had a big Queenie Huff and flounced off on the morning the Brexit result came through, he said that one of his proudest achievements was same-sex marriage. He didn't actually put that in the 2010 manifesto. He sprung that on his voters completely out of the blue. Then we got Theresa May. And Nigel has my old boss, Dominic Lawson. Former editor of the Sunday Telegraph. Dominic has a theory that it was the same-sex marriage vote that actually bounced all these shyer Tories into moving to UKIP and thus allowed the Brexit referendum to happen and again be lost by Cameron. And Dominic has that. Dominic, if I recall correctly, supported same-sex marriage, but he recognised that not putting it in the manifesto or whatever, you make yourself look like a devious creep. Then we had Theresa May, who was elected in the wake of Cameron's flouncing off in a big Queenie Huff. And all she did was attempt to subvert Brexit. Then we had Boris, who attempted to sell himself as the man who would get Brexit done and has wound up with reducing the United Kingdom to, as I often say, and as I made the point in my book, The Prisoner of Windsor, which turned out to be completely correct. Reduced it to the status of a princely state in British India, where you have you are not officially part of the official order, but you have no say in everything, but you just do as you're told. As Britain, we have internal borders within the United Kingdom because Boris Johnson, a fake and a fraud and an opportunist, decided to sell out Northern Ireland through the Northern Ireland Protocol, and then with the Windsor Framework, Rishi Sunak basically put England, Scotland and Wales into the Northern Ireland Protocol. So there's no Brexit. Sue, I think it's better to vote for something, and I think it's better to actually, and again, I make the point, the Tories have had 14 years. They had an 80-seat majority these last 5 years and yet have been unable to govern effectively. But people now think, the argument now is that depending on whether they have 78 seats or 32 seats will make the difference between them being an effective opposition. They can't be an effective opposition because all Starmer is going to do is the stuff that these fake Tories did, only more so. I'd like a genuine right of centre party in the United Kingdom, and this one isn't it. So no, I am at odds, and I take his point. There will be a lot of constitutional damage, but you know, The Tories have done a lot of constitutional damage too, like the Northern Ireland Protocol, like the Windsor Framework. They've done an awful lot of non-constitutional damage, like the Tories advancing the bill that now gives control of the internet to Ofcom. So screw the Tories. They're actually far worse than Kim Campbell and the Canadian Tories were in 1992. So it's what matters is, it doesn't matter whether they win seats, win every seat. What matters is that you drive up as high as possible Reform's vote. In other words, that on the Friday morning, they're not just talking about who's going to be the Tory leader of the opposition. They're going to be talking about whether the Tories have enough support as to even survive. Let's pause a moment from the passing Charivari. As you know, we've moved all the music on this show over to Serenade Radio, Saturdays at 5 p.m. London time, in order to free up more time here to talk about Mitch McConnell and Nikki Haley, the really important things that people want to talk about. However, I have been worried of late that along with my ventricles, my vocabulary has been shrinking. So yesterday I made a conscious effort to broaden it, and in my Tuesday column used the word Megillah, a Jewish word, which led to various emails from Jewish readers complaining I hadn't spelled it correctly, which made me a bit tetchy, a bit cranky. Minded to sign up with the Quiz for Palestine. I gather from their disruptions of recent pride parades that there's very little actual homosexuality required in Quiz for Palestine these days. Anyway, my only familiarity with the word came from the phrase "the whole Megillah" in a Frank Sinatra movie theme from the 60s. The word struck me, first time I heard it, as a kid. And back in the 80s, I asked Sammy Kahn, the song's lyricist, about it. And Sammy told me Sinatra wasn't sure about Megillah in the lyric. He was a bit worried nobody would know what the word meant. But Sammy liked it and wanted to keep it, and he won that one. He persuaded Frank to get on board, and he helped, therefore, put the expression in more general currency. So keep an eye out for it. It's coming up, the theme to a Neil Simon movie from 60 years ago. I'll give you the whole Megillah in a one-word speech.
Make like a Mr. Milquetoast and you'll get shut out. Make like a Mr. Meek and you'll get cut out. Make like a little lamb and wham, you're shorn. I tell you, chum, it's time to come blow your horn. Make like a Mr. Mumbles and you're a zero. Make like a Mr. Big, they dig a hero. You've got to sound your A the day you're born. I tell you, chum, it's time to come blow your horn. The taller the tree, the sweeter the peach, I'll give you the whole Megillah in a one-word speech. Reach, make like the world's your pudding, but light the brandy. Even the mildest kiss is a dandy. There'll be no love in bloom come doomsday morn. I tell you, chum, it's time to come blow your horn. In civilized jungles, the females adore the lions who come on swinging. If you
want to score, roar. You can be either read to or be the reader. You can be either led or be the leader. Don't wait until you're told you're old and worn. Take in some air and get your lips puckered before you find you're simply too tuckered. I'll tell you, chum, it's time to come blow your horn. Blow your horn. I tell you, chum, it's time to come blow your horn.
Yeah, if you want to score, roar. That's good advice, although I'm not sure you're allowed to give it these days. Ring-a-ding-ding, Frank Sinatra, with orchestra arranged and conducted by Nelson Riddle, music by Jimmy Van Heusen, words by Sammy Kahn, including the word Megillah. More Sinatra on Serenade Radio this Saturday. We are live around the planet. It is 20 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That's 20 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent Earth. Let's get back to your questions. Oh, Stefan Buchek says, Mark, I thought to let you know that On the Town has become my favourite radio show. Each week, I don my headphones so I can listen to the stereophonic sounds of your musical treasure trove, even if the recordings are in mono. I know we play a few stereo things. I think this week I've got a hit from 1924. That is almost certainly mono. Stefan continues, I can shut out the rest of the world while I learn about musical oddities, recordings I hadn't heard before, and enjoy a new Sinatra sextet. I especially like the merry-go-round broke down from a couple of Saturdays back. I never realized that the Looney Tunes theme came from an actual song. Yes, indeed it did, Stefan, by Cliff Friend and... Charles Tobias wrote the words. Cliff Friend's fantastic tune. Now all those hours, says Stefan, I spend in front of the TV as a youth are somewhat redeemed by this bit of trivia. I look forward to future episodes of On the Town. And may you stay hale and hearty so that we can be the beneficiaries of your encyclopedic musical knowledge for years to come. Might I suggest that when Columbus Day rolls around, you might play the Lou Monte ditty? Please, Mr. Columbus, God bless you, sir, and tell the authorities over the pond that they can bugger off, com. Lou Monte, funnily enough, I've had my youngest kid here after my last heart attack. He decided he needed to come home to... take care of me. I've been very lucky to survive that. Fingers crossed. But oddly enough, we were actually talking about Lou Monte because when he was a kid, I liked to traumatize the kids come Christmas time by singing Lou Monte's Christmas hit. Let me see if, how does it go again? Jiggity jiggy or your Dominic the donkey, jiggity jiggy or your Italian Christmas donkey, la la la. And on long car rides, I used to insist on singing that to the kids. They even now, if you just bring up the first line or even the title, they start twitching. It made its impact. Patrick Gagan says, hello, Mark. I just wanted to lighten the mood for a moment and say to you what I never got to express to Rush Limbaugh. I appreciate and love everything that you do. You, like my father, and Rush, Walter Williams, and Thomas Sowell are my hero. Thank you, says Patrick. That's very kind of you. I was thinking about Rush when... my dear cat Marvin died just 2 weeks ago. because as I mentioned, I think when Marvin brought out our cat album, Feline Groovy, Marvin sent a copy to Rush's cat, Ally. And Ally sent back a nice thank you note and apparently enjoyed the album. And Ally and Marvin corresponded for a while. And so I feel sad because Ally is gone and Rush is gone and Marvin is gone. And I'm the only one of the quartet still around. So it's beginning to take on the same character as that dinner thrown by the late Duke of Edinburgh at Buckingham Palace, where I'm now the only guy still alive from. Bart Nielsen says, praying and for healing and strength for you. You are the indispensable man for our time. Just wondering if you can remediate my benighted public school education and tell me where is Honkers. I think that's a reference to our time zone recitation. I always go Singapore and Honkers. It's 3 a.m. Sorry about that. I generally say something like that. Honkers is Hong Kong. I think I use the word Honkers in A Prisoner of Windsor, because one of the cabinet ministers is recently returned from Honkers. But they always used to say about the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC, which no longer operates in the United States because they concluded that the cost of operating in the United States under regulation by the government of the United States was too high. So HSBC is no longer in America, but it's still going other places. That stands for Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. And in my days at the BBC, for example, I had a friend who was one of the financial guys at the BBC, and the old line in the City of London at that time was Honkers and Shankers, best city bankers. And that's so that's where that comes from, Bart. Queen of the Jungle says, dear Mark, you've been our knight in shining armor. Oh, come on, whoever's putting up the questions. We can't have all these ones comparing me to Thomas Sowell and all the rest of it. You've been our knight in shining armor, says Queen of the Jungle, for many years, always the one to prove that the pen is indeed mightier than the sword. That ought to be true, but there are a lot of restrictions on what the pen is permitted to do these days. I would like to believe that the pen is mightier than the sword, but we're going to end up with swords because governments around the world are restraining what you can say with the pen, so you'll have no alternative but to pick up the sword. Anyway, Queen of the Jungle continues, no matter what the circumstances, no matter how badly you may be wounded, you never flinch or hesitate and get right back into the fray to defend what's left of the honour of the formerly free world. Which leads me to my first question. What inspires your courage and strength? What enables you to keep going even when the odds are against you? In short, how do you remain absolutely fearless despite knowing all that you do about what our enemies are capable of doing? Well, it's precisely because I do know that that I take what's happening seriously. As I always say, the big story, all the rest is just details. They're just little details of the same picture. But the big story is that Western civilization is sliding off the cliff on America's watch. And what that means is that unless that changes, the future is going to be built elsewhere. The future is going to be made elsewhere. It doesn't matter whether it's being made by Chairman Xi in Peking, or the Mullahs, or Putin, or the World Economic Forum. We're having a grand closing down, final weekend, massive store-wide clearances going out of business sale. And I mentioned my kids, and how I like to traumatize them by singing Jiggity Jiggy Oyo, Dominic the Donkey. I pine for a world where that is the most traumatic thing that can happen to you, because They're going to live in a terrible world, absolutely terrible world. And they are going to be induced by the monsters who have made this world. And I'm not here talking about the migrant hordes admitted to Europe and North America. I'm talking about the Western governments that arranged for this to happen. So the people are now being taught that it's perfectly normal in France for 12-year-old girls to get kidnapped and gang raped. They're being taught something similar at the hands of Latin American gangs in the United States. They're conditioning us to take the most civilized societies and accept that life in them is now crap and violent. And I don't accept that, and that's the... I'll just say this too, as a writer, I remember Mordecai Richler, my late friend. We were having lunch at Le Mas des Oliviers in Montreal, and he was expounding on his point that writers write because of a fear of death. You know, we're all here just for 70 or whatever it is, or what with all this sudden death syndrome, it's looking more like 70. But his theory was that writers write because of a fear of death, so that his account of how it was is there and survives. Well, that's fine and dandy, but that assumes a system of civilizational survival. In other words, if your civilization is going off the cliff, all the past goes with it too. And that doesn't matter whether you're talking about some nice sonata or whether you're talking about 80s rock. If it means nothing to the people who succeed you, it's not going to be there. And so that's another reason I do it. We now have some of the top tech experts, continues Queen of the Jungle, who have identified the problems with the voter rolls that contain millions of dead, non-existent, illegal or ineligible voters. Not only have the problems been explained ad nauseum for the last 4 years, but the solutions are out there as well. Question, in your opinion, why doesn't the RNC and GOP do something to stop the steal before it happens? Not a day goes by that I don't read an article by one of these tech geniuses telling how they offered their programs to various RNC bigwigs to no avail. If they think they can litigate the fraud before or after November the 5th, they are badly mistaken, as I'm sure you would tell them. I would love to know your thoughts on this, oh great one. Oh great one? That's someone else, isn't it? Anyway, thank you for your question. And the electoral system in America is insane. My line, you've heard it all before. There's no point having the greatest constitution in the world if you have the worst election system in the world. And we see that in some of these increasingly whimsical decisions coming out of the United States Supreme Court. I was just looking at the timeline for the United Kingdom's election tomorrow. Usually the last constituencies to declare are the Northern Ireland constituencies, because historically that was the only place where there was any real fraud. And in fairness to it, doesn't matter. I mean, because you'd expect it to be, because they don't agree on what country they're in. I think the seat Sinn Féin one in 2019, I think that's the most marginal seat in the UK, and so they'll want to win it again. And in the bad old days, they actually had, because people didn't query little girls and elderly women, so they'd find blokes that they could pass off as little girls or elderly women. You had to actually get dress up to partake in voter fraud under the UK system. It's not like that in the United States. In the United States, the practices are designed to enable fraud, and that includes what happened last time round, where you extend voting for weeks beforehand and counting for weeks afterwards. The reason some elections are fair is because the polls open at 7 a.m. and close at 7 p.m. or whatever. So if you want to steal the election, you've only got 12 hours in which to do it. If you have systems that advantage Democrats and which the Republican Party goes along with, then don't be surprised if you have corrupt elections. That's to go back to the point I made earlier. The problem with Biden, it's a marvelous idea thinking we won't bother with these like candidates who think they're on top of their briefs and all the rest of it. We'll get a guy who's already dead and we'll just wheel him around. We'll prop him up in front of the prompter and all the rest of it, and he can be the president. But the problem now for the Democrats is that the steal is going to have to be on a scale. It's increasingly on a nationwide scale. Oh, we have to steal New Hampshire, and then we have to hurry over to New Mexico and steal that. That's going to require a whole other scale of election fraud. And the way to do it would be to have the same boring kinds of elections that the French... I mean, the French had their first round of their election on Saturday. Basically, the exit poll came up with the numbers at, I forget what it was. Was it 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock local time? And they announced them. And yeah, there was a 0.0 this and a 0.0 that the following morning when the actual results came through. But not really. And it's not difficult to do. It's not difficult to do. And so when the world's so-called superpower declines to do it, you have to understand that it's deliberate. George Pereira writes, Mark, French feminists protested France's growing right-wing politics by moping the streets of Paris. Moping? Mopping? The streets of Paris while topless. They were also shrieking something incoherently, convincing me at least that French is no longer the language of love. Is this Trump's fault? I honestly don't think the vote for Marine Le Pen's party is going to be impacted by topless women. It might in some countries. You know, I always remember as a kid in France. I always quite enjoyed it as a kid, as you would expect me to. But I always liked, quite like the way that you'd just round a corner and there'd be a billboard. And it'd be some topless bird, you know, holding up a can of soup or whatever. And they were using a topless woman to advertise the can of soup. I don't think there's many Frenchmen who haven't seen topless women. And the idea of topless women throwing their lot in with the Uniparty is bizarre to me. These are just absurd and self-indulgent gestures. And they reflect the disconnect between French cities. By the way, I would be interested, given that the demographic energy in these cities, one of the interesting things about the UK election is it's I think 200 of the most marginal constituencies, the biggest minority in those constituencies are the Muslims. So if the Muslims are that mad about Sir Keir Starmer being too supportive of Israel and Lady Starmer being a sinister Jewess, raising the Starmer's kids as Jews, that disaffected Muslim vote, enough of it could transfer to independent candidates to cause Labour a few problems there. But it's the same in the French cities. The demographic energy is all Muslim. So I tell you what, topless ladies, topless French birds, because we all like topless French birds. So why don't you go and protest Marine Le Pen topless in the Les Banlieues, the Muslim quartier of French cities. See how that works out for you. See how that works out for you protesting topless in the Muslim quartier of France. Pat Smith says, best wishes on your recovery. Is there a timetable for the Ofcom decision? Will it come out before the Intergalactic Court of Justice issues their ruling on the Michael Mann case? Well, the English High Court will be done with the Ofcom decision at this rate long before the final motions are dealt with at the District of Columbia Superior Court. You know, I'm psychologically, I've checked out of there and I'm on to the appellate phase, but we haven't actually finished because there's still all the, you know, tosspotting around that's going on in the DC Superior Court with various motions for this and that. The English High Court, the King's Bench Division, Her Ladyship indicated that she would be issuing her decision in a few weeks. And, you know, if we then have to seek leave to appeal, that will go on a bit. But either way, this case will be wrapped up before the American case, because in America, as again, you can all sing along with this, I only have my greatest hits these days. I'm a bit like all those rock bands that so many of you boomer type chappies like. I don't have any new material. I just revive the old favourites. But as I always say, the process is the punishment. The process is what beggars you, what ruins you. And the process will be a while yet in the dank septic tank of District of Columbia Justice. The Notorious Mr. J says, best wishes and an admonition to sacrifice as many goats and oxen as feasible to the gods of health. Is it just me, or is electoral farce and disaster sweeping the free world? Both America and Great Britain are rushing toward elections where none of the above would be a shoo-in. France is lurching to a final vote that could result in violence on the streets. The dictators of the world are most surely buttering their popcorn for a fun show. Well, this is all a result, generally speaking, of the political class in Western nations attempting to constrain choices to Tweedle left and Tweedle right. I don't really agree with you on America about none of the above. I think it's necessary to drag Trump over the finish line as an act of political hygiene and a repudiation of the past 4 years. And I don't think swapping Trump out for Nikki Haley or John Kasich or Chris Christie would do that. As I said, it's necessary to have an explicit, as an act of political hygiene. This has nothing to do with how Trump's first term went or how his second term is likely to go. It's an act of political hygiene. In Britain, as I said, for 14 years, a fake Conservative Party has betrayed its base by governing as lefties on almost anything that matters, and including the subversion of Brexit. In France, in continental Europe, things are a little bit different because the so-called far right, the extreme right. I mentioned my kid was here. We were listening to a bit of the French news coverage on whatever it was, the night of the election. I was listening to the way they say extrême droite. It's like the drinking game. You don't need to speak any French. If you just understand the words extrême droite, they say them like every 8.3 seconds. Extrême droite, extrême droite. As I mentioned, in the French commune I know best, 47% voted for the extreme droite, the extreme right. So they're not really that extreme. And we need something extreme. Something has to... We can't... I've been writing about this for 20 years now. It's going to be the 20th anniversary of America alone. Well, I explain what was happening. And as I said, the great tragedy of that book is that in the fall of 2006... I got all these invitations to come and talk to princes and presidents and prime ministers. Some of those princes are now kings. And they all listened carefully to what I had to say, and they all did nothing. So it's necessary, and that's the other reason for not voting for this grisly Conservative Party in the UK, because they did nothing for 14 years. They said, oh yes, we're going to cut immigration to a few thousand a year, a four-figure sum. And instead, you have net immigration. Well, and actually, I don't even believe in the net immigration figure, because if, you know, so, oh, it's only net immigration of 500,000. If net immigration means that 500,000 Anglo-Celts abandon the British Isles and 1 million Sudanese and Somalis come in, but don't worry because it's only 500,000 net, that 500,000 net is transformative. They did nothing. I'm sick. I'm sick of sellouts. I'm sick of sellouts. There is nobody. When I was in London a couple of weeks ago, I didn't go into the Carlton Club, the Tory Club in St. James's, because to see any of those people, as weak and enfeebled and as heart attack prone as I am, I accept the ladies, whatever one makes of them. You know, I'm not going to sock Priti Patel and Penny Mordaunt in the jaw, but it's too provocative being ushered into the presence of these ghastly fake Tories. I don't want... it's time to put an end to them. AJ says, dear Mark, the calls for both Biden and Trudeau seem to be growing louder and louder, and most Conservatives seem to think this is a good thing, but it makes me nervous. Should Trudeau and his ego step aside, there's a good chance that someone like Mark Carney... Mark Carney, for those who don't know him, is the former governor of the Bank of Canada, former governor of the Bank of England, and he's currently heading up some climate boondoggle for the World Economic Forum, I think. There's a good chance that someone like Mark Carney will come in behind him to take over. The problem with that is that the Carneys of the world would keep us on the same trajectory, or perhaps even hasten our free fall into globalist tyranny. But they seem like a safe option for all of those liberals to support. A liberal whose conscience has been pushed to the brink by the disgusting antics of Trudeau might right now be prepared to put an X beside Conservative Poilievre, but a swap out to Carney or some other Liberal appointee of the WEF would cause that pang of conscience to evaporate. The same is true of the situation in the US Democratic Party. The names being floated to replace Biden are appalling political creatures, but we don't have hours of footage of them demonstrating their dementia. Just hours of footage of them destroying the country and blaming the citizenry for it. All very easy to overcome for a loyal Democrat voter. Do you think Conservatives should be angling to keep Trudeau and Biden in place until their respective elections, so that the voters' choice remains stark and clear? Well, they don't have any say in the matter, AJ. It will be the Liberal Party that determines the future of Trudeau, and it will be Democrats that determines the future of Biden. Rishi Sunak has... I talked about the swinging pendulums, you know, after 18 years... of Thatcher Tories and then Blairite Labour came in 1997. And Rishi Sunak has attempted to argue that as he's not David Cameron, he's not Theresa May, he's not Boris Johnson, the pendulum has already swung and he's the new guy. And that hasn't worked out for him, and I'm not sure it would work out for Mark Carney in Ottawa. I'm not sure it would work out for the Democrats. And as I said, the only Democrat it's going to be is Kamala Harris, because everything else is a mess. Everything else would ensure that a mess goes on throughout the summer and into the final weeks of the US election campaign. The important thing to remember is the fakey, fake, fakery of it all. You know, as I said, we have these... The entire, the New York Times and the Washington Post doing a Claude Rains in Casablanca and claiming to be shocked to find dementia going on in this White House. It's completely preposterous. So we're simply watching another variant of the theatre. Of the political theater here. William says, I said this in my piece this morning, talking about the Lincoln Project, which has put up this astonishing video. It's made a video salivating over the prospect of Steve Bannon being raped in prison. And I said, do you remember the Lincoln Project? And William says, I think you mean the North American Man-Boy Lincoln Association. Yeah, the new NAMBLA. As I said, what's he called? John Weaver, the guy who likes hitting on 14-year-old boys. He was a consultant to McCain. John Weaver founded the NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Lincoln Association, as a sort of gay pedo front. What's this question here? From Biddeford Jake. He says, dear Mark, I heard a demographer recently talking about birth gap, a childless world, who claimed that immigrant birth rates usually fell into line with the native population after only one generation. Ding, 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 ding. Wrong. He claimed the US and Germany were examples of this. As someone who fears a Muslim majority in England in the not too distant future, I found this surprising. It's now over one generation ago since Tony Blair let down the drawbridge to all and sundry. From what I can glean, the native birth rate is now 1.4, while the Muslim equivalent is between 2.9 and 3.4. Let's just get this bollocks out of the way. If this was a demographer, the United Kingdom is a very interesting example of this. Pakistanis who arrived in the 60s and 70s with more or less conventional Pakistani-sized families. And they then, the next generation, it did decline, actually. But then, this is the interesting point, once the Pakistani population, the Pakistani Muslim population, increased in places like Yorkshire and reached a critical mass, the birth rates of those communities went up, because they were now big enough to exist as conventional Pakistani family communities, where you marry your first cousin, and if you don't have a first cousin, you bring a first cousin over from Pakistan, and you have traditional Pakistani-sized families. So that isn't true. The fact of the matter is, in any case, is that demographics is a game of last man standing, so that if your fertility rate began declining in 1960 and the immigrants' fertility rate doesn't begin declining until 2025, they'll still win. Because you can have, again, the point I often make is if you take the European numbers, where it's estimated that native Europeans have 1.3 children per couple, basically they're halving with every generation. Whereas European Muslims are estimated to have, as you said, 3.5 children per couple. You're a little lower than that, Biddeford Jake. You say 3.4. Well, the 1.3 and the 3.5 catch up within two generations. They both have roughly the same number of grandkids. Now, you add into that continuous, remorseless mass migration, like 1,000 Albanian males washing up on the shores of England overnight, and you're going to be demographically overwhelmed. People are innumerate. I've said, here's the thing that I did. I think I first said it when Ava and I were talking about Ava Vladingerbrook, and I were talking on one show about one of these horror stories out of France, little children getting stabbed in a park in Annecy. And I had noticed that, you know, people like David Starkey, for example, who's a very sharp guy, very bright guy. But I remember being astonished when he said to me on the show once that, oh, well, yeah, we've got these people in the big cities. They're unrecognizable now, but there's still plenty of suburbs and leafy villages. No, eventually it's everywhere. And in France, as I mentioned to Ava, it's now any town of approximately 3,000 and up. So you will see covered women and you will see the gangs of men and all the rest of it. Bedford Jake adds, Neil Oliver interviewed Leilani Dowding recently and started off by saying, I first saw Leilani on the Mark Steyn show. Mark Steyn is one of the greatest, most incisive presenters of any age. Well said, Neil. I do miss those early GB News Steyn shows and the flying by the seat of your pants thrill and did he just say that astonishment they evoked as you battled gremlins, time delays, disappearing captions and clueless technicians. I really felt for you trying to keep a lid on it. Well, it wasn't really funny that. I learned, or a colleague of mine learned, like at GB News, for example, so-called mass control room. They hated the presenters. And I'm not the only one, they would attempt to sabotage. They hate Dan Wharton and always tried to sabotage him, for example. And so eventually we wound up taking on more and more and more of it ourselves, including things like the prompter operator, simply because they were such garbage there. Doing it that way wasn't fun, and I don't miss that at all. I miss the fact that we were able to talk about real things, such as has not been spoken about in this election, such as the madness of lockdown even before the vaccines came along, and you have these insane excess death numbers that no party wants to talk about. It doesn't matter whether it's the Conservatives or Sinn Féin, they're all on board with the bollocks. And also talking about the so-called grooming gangs, which is a ridiculous euphemism, they're Muslim rape gangs operating with impunity up and down the spine of England. And interestingly, someone who was supposed to be literally a champion of the poor raped girl, Sarah Champion, has now become a big Muslim suck-up, simply because, as I said, in the 200 most marginal constituencies, the Muslims are the biggest minority. And in a democratic society, you cannot write them off. We are passing the point of no return, as I started saying 20 years ago, when we still could have done something about it. It's sad that, but I'm glad to see Leilani prospering and appearing on Neil's show. This has been Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A across the planet. You want closing music? Tough, tough, tough. We've moved all that to Saturdays on Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time, which is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, or 12 noon North American Eastern. Hope you'll join me this weekend, because by moving all the music to a dedicated show, we have freed up a lot of space in order to talk about Chris Christie and Nikki Haley and whatever. But that's going to do it for today. Stick with Steyn Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, come on in. The water's fine. And don't forget, for the Steyn shy chum in your life, there's a Mark Steyn Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Happy Liberation Day to any of our listeners in Belarus, and for tomorrow, to our American listeners, have an absolutely terrific Independence Day and assert your independence. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay independent.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.